This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio. Today I have with me in the studio Sandy Horwitt, author of a brand new biography on Wisconsin Senator Russ Feingold, simply called Feingold. Sandy Horwitt, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Good to be here, Matt.
What got you interested in Russ Feingold and doing a biography on him?
Well, he first caught my attention when he ran for re-election in 1998. And it was that election in which he risked his political career to really make a point about how corrupting large political unregulated contributions had become to the political process. And he did two things in that election that were extraordinary, really unprecedented in modern times. One, he agreed with his opponent to limit the overall spending of the campaign. In Wisconsin, it was $1 per voter, approximately $3.5 million in total. But then he went a big step further than his opponent, and he told the National Democratic Party that he would not accept any of these large checks. The soft money was the jargon in Washington at the time, and that made all the difference in his reelection campaign. That is, his opponent ended up with a huge advantage when it came to spending money.
You know, people thought he was going to lose that race because of that, and he was running against a real right-winger who practically was robotic and didn't even blink. And I found out in this book, Feingold, Sandy Horwitt, that McCain called him the night of the election and basically was saying, you know, you ran a brave race as though he had lost it, and Feingold assured him that he was going to pull it out.
Right, exactly. I happened to be, by just happenstance, in the office in Washington, actually in Alexandria, Virginia, of a Republican consulting firm, a territory I hardly ever visit. But for odd reasons, I was there about 2 weeks before that election, and the partner of this Republican polling firm that had been doing work for Tommy Thompson here in Wisconsin just said, Feingold's toast. And that is the general view, I think, in Washington. The two nights before the election on Meet the Press, all of the pundits, when asked who was going to win that Wisconsin race, they all said Feingold's opponent.
Did you interview Russ Feingold for this?
I did. I started interviewing Feingold in 2001. After that 98 election, I was intrigued and then started sitting in the back of the room at some of his listening sessions and became more intrigued. And by 2001, I really thought that there was a very good story and a very good book. And that's when I approached him and we started what turned out to be 14 formal interviews over about a six-year period, plus a lot of more informal conversations.
What's he like, just one-on-one?
He is very much like he is publicly. He lets his hair down maybe a little bit more when you're sitting in his den in Middleton on a Saturday morning, which we did on occasion. He has a great sense of humor, which you don't see very much publicly. I remember the great Molly Ivins, who graced the pages of your Progressive magazine, was a big fan of Feingold's, but I heard her say kind of under her breath once on C-SPAN that, of course, he's kind of dull. And really, Russ Feingold is not dull. The people who know him really well in Madison and from his Janesville days, you know, think he has this great sense of humor, and he does, and he's a lot of fun. But a lot of that does not come across so readily publicly.
Why is that? Do you think he's afraid of slipping or something?
Well, I think he, like other politicians, even though he's so distinctive in so many ways, in this case, I think it's a little bit like a lot of other politicians, that he thinks that there is a, you know, sort of proper, appropriate way to behave and to come across in the public forum. And that tends to be in a more serious mode. And really, he has been dealing with some of the most serious issues, especially in the last half dozen years, the war in Iraq, for starters, and then all the civil liberties-related issues in this post-9/11 period.
He was out front on the Iraq War. Why do you think he was able to see through the morass more clearly than others?
Well, I think for a couple of reasons. One, he is an independent thinker. And this is one of the things that I discovered for my own education about who Russ Feingold was when I really started talking with him and his classmates going back to school in Janesville when he was in middle school and high school, and certainly at Madison when he was at the University of Wisconsin. So he doesn't accept a lot of people's broad sweeping generalizations and assumptions. So that's one thing I think that's very important. Secondly, I think Russ Feingold is very skeptical about the use of military power. He's not totally opposed to it. He is certainly not a pacifist. He voted for the U.S. Military attack in Afghanistan right after 9/11. But his inclination is to really see if there are alternatives to the use of military power. And in Iraq, there was such a rush that the Bush administration, through both Bush and Cheney, were trying to stampede Congress, and successfully did, of course. And that's not something that Russ Feingold is going to allow to happen to him.
In that respect, Sandy Horwitt, Russ Feingold is very much like the great heralded Wisconsin politician, sainted by now, Robert La Follette, who was the founder of the Progressive magazine, but much more than that, was the leader of the left wing of the progressive movement in U.S. history at the turn of the 19th, 20th century, and up to the point where he ran for president on the Progressive Party ticket in 1924. Does Feingold revere La Follette? Does he see himself in La Follette's footsteps?
Absolutely. I think Russ Feingold may be the closest thing, and actually fairly close, of a reincarnation of Fighting Bob La Follette that we have on the national stage in this country. I actually wrote in the book a line that Russ Feingold is the most authentic progressive voice on the national stage today. And really, this comes right out of his family. Leon Feingold, his father, who graduated from the University of Wisconsin Law School in 1937, ran as under the banner of the Wisconsin Progressive Party in 1938, 1 year out of law school, for district attorney of Rock County, of which Janesville is the county seat. And since that was such a staunchly conservative Republican county, Leon Feingold did not fare very well. He lost by about 2-1.
Say, why did he not then encourage Russ to run? Because you write in this book that Russ's dad did not encourage him to run for elect office.
Well, it was a little bit the way parents, talk to their children. Don't do what I did, do what I say. So you always want your children to have it better and easier. And Leon Feingold apparently thought that holding elective office, especially at higher levels where the demands are especially great, was not a good way to lead a family life. And I think that was one of the main reasons. Leon Feingold certainly was a bit of a, if not a contradiction, at least someone inconsistent, because he spent a lot of his time as an adult working on the campaigns for others, especially for progressive judicial candidates.
You mentioned leading a family life and the tensions there with any elected official, especially national ones. Russ Feingold has been divorced twice. To what extent has his political career resulted in those divorces?
I'm not sure I really know the specific answer. I did not talk to Russ Feingold in very much detail about the why of the divorce. We definitely talked about his marriages. His first marriage was a college sweetheart. They met the first week that both him and his wife's name was Sue Levine at the time, met and as freshmen. But they've been divorced for more than 20 years. And I, as a biographer, I took the view that since this was really a political biography, that other than really acknowledging that there have been two divorces and talking a little bit more than that, that I really wasn't so interested in that piece of Russ Feingold's personal life, as long as it didn't connect in some very tight way to his role as a public official. But getting just one last quick comment, Matt, on your question, you know, Russ Feingold is about as dedicated a public official as I can imagine. He is back here in Wisconsin every weekend, but when he's back, or practically every weekend, but when he's back here, he's often on the road. He made this commitment in 1992 that if he were elected, he'd go to each of the 72 counties every year for a listening session, and that's only part of the agenda he has when he comes back here. So the demands for someone who really gives his or her all to public life are considerable, and you have to have an extremely understanding spouse, it seems to me, to put up with this.
I'm speaking with Sandy Horwitt, author of a brand new biography on Russ Feingold. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. What surprised you most about Feingold in doing this book? I'll tell you what surprised me most, the fact that he did a thesis on the Second Amendment. That was something I didn't know.
Well, I didn't know that either, although I first heard it. I mean, I eventually discovered it, but he talks about it at some of his listening sessions, especially, you know, up north where, you know, hunting is a very important part of the culture and of commerce and the economy. And I think he uses his college senior thesis to good effect by showing people that long ago when he was, a senior in Madison, that he already was very sensitive to Second Amendment rights. And he was, there is another good example, by the way, Matt, of both independent thinking and someone who really was a bit ahead of his time, because it took another 10 or 15 years before a few prominent liberal scholars, Sanford Levinson at the University of Texas and Lawrence Tribe at Harvard Law School, really came to a very similar position that this 21-year-old Russ Feingold arrived at in 1975, and that is that the Second Amendment really does confer some basic constitutional rights on the on citizens to own a firearm.
So that it's an individual's right, not just the state militia interpretation, which some people had been using really for decades. He's been courageous in some other ways. I mean, the issues, the most controversial issues that Feingold wrestled with, certainly initially, and you go into this in your book, was his vote to continue the impeachment proceedings against Clinton. That and his vote to approve Ashcroft as Attorney General, I think, were the two votes that got him into the most trouble with his base, with his progressive base. Do you think he was torn by that and surprised by the heat of the vitriol that came at him for either of those?
I don't think he was surprised. He was prepared, I think, for that kind of reaction. I think I write in the book, and I quote him as saying that he, you know, agonized in part on that impeachment vote to continue the Senate trial because he had just come out of that 1998 campaign and won by a very small margin because he put himself at such a big spending disadvantage in that campaign. And he knew his supporters, as he put it, had carried him across the line. And here, just months later, he was going to vote with Republicans who I think good hardcore Democrats think had railroaded Bill Clinton into this impeachment situation. So yeah, that was not a surprise, the kind of
reaction. Why did he vote for it?
Well, he said that he had taken an oath along with the other senators, which was different than the constitutional oath when you first enter the Senate. This was an oath to be an impartial juror during the Senate trial, and that he felt that all the evidence really had to be presented. And he, as he put it at the time, he could not say with total assurance that if the managers of that trial, the Republican managers, had presented enough evidence that he, Russ Feingold, might have found at least on one of those two counts that President Clinton was in fact guilty. It turns out that's not what Feingold determined. He voted against both of the articles of impeachment.
Did he ever catch flack from Bill or Hillary Clinton on that vote?
Well, I don't know if he did directly. He never told me he did directly. But I do write in the book about an episode involving a memorial service for the former governor and senator of of Florida, Lawton Childs, that was held in Washington. And a lot of people who were at that service thought that President Clinton, when he gave a eulogy, made a veiled criticism of Russ Feingold for being holier than thou, comparing him to Lawton Childs and the way Lawton Childs handled campaign finance reform issues.
Feingold's proudest moment, I believe, was his solitary vote against the USA Patriot Act in 2001. The vote in the Senate was 98-1. How did he withstand the herd there, and also the panic that was involved after the attack of 9/11, and all the patriotic pleadings from not only Bush but from his own leadership to stand up and say, "No, I'm not going to vote for this."
Well, you know, I think that it's fair to say, as you did, that that was an extraordinarily courageous vote on Feingold's part. He told his staff that he thought that ultimately there would be a lot of people who would share his view that this was a extremely flawed piece of legislation, and in that respect, you could say that he thought that maybe it wasn't such a risky act at the vote at the time. But boy, Matt, I live in the Washington, D.C. area, and the fear, both personal and political, this was just a month or so after the 9/11 attack, including at the Pentagon right outside of Washington.
And we all saw the images of the senators and representatives running out of the Capitol.
Well, exactly, because the plane that went down in Pennsylvania supposedly was headed back either for the White House or for the U.S. Capitol. So the fear was, you can hardly exaggerate how much fear there was in Washington. And I think, again, it's a sign of Russ Feingold's independent thinking, his real commitment, a genuine commitment to civil liberties. And then I think there was a third factor. And the third factor was he is very resentful of even his own party pushing something through in a way that just smothers any legitimate criticism. So I think he got quite upset with his majority leader at the time, Tom Daschle, who didn't even allow for a markup and a chance to amend the Patriot Act in the Senate Judiciary Committee, of which Feingold is a member. And suddenly, this bill was brought to the floor.
I heard a story, I don't know if it's true, that Daschle basically told him to shut up.
Well, I think that's right. He did. And as I write in the book, there was a shouting match in the corner of the Senate floor between Russ Feingold and Daschle over what we're just talking about, this stampede to the floor, no chance to amend the bill in committee, which would have been the normal course.
Well, a lot of us wanted Russ Feingold to run for president and were shocked that he decided not to. Because even as he admits to you, Sandy Horwood, here in this brand new biography, Feingold, he admits that when he was a little kid, he wanted to run for president. He wanted to be the first Jewish president of the United States. And so it came as a surprise to me, who knew that about his background and his lifelong ambition to be president of the United States, that at this moment where he'd have a chance, or thought he might have had a chance, that he took himself off the stage. Why?
Well, you know, he hasn't been all that precise about the reason or reasons that he decided not to run. I agree with what you just said. A lot of people, you know, pretty close friends and even some relatives, were quite surprised when he decided not to run. And I had followed him around to some of the primary states he had visited in both 2005 and 2006, and he got extremely strong positive responses, and particularly because of his vote against the USA Patriot Act. I write that he discovered after, you know, doing the preliminaries, that he decided that he didn't want to turn his life upside down, and that this time around he didn't quite have the burning desire to run, leaving the door open, I think it's fair to say, for a run either next time or the time after that. He's only 54 years old. I must say that also that while he didn't say this to me, that the meteoric rise of Barack Obama certainly, you know, kind of complicated the dynamics of the primary field. And Obama just came out of almost nowhere just within the latter part of 2006. So, you know, whether that was a significant factor, I can't really say for sure, but it certainly didn't help, I think, the process for a Feingold candidacy.
It just kind of took the air out of the room. I remember John Nichols of The Nation and the Capital Times of Madison bumping into him at a coffee house right after Feingold stepped down, and he said, well, here's the reason. And he held up a copy of Time magazine that had Barack Obama's face on it and a copy of Madison magazine that had Russ Feingold's face on it, and he said, you know, Russ Feingold should be on Time magazine if he wants to be president. So that was a concern. So you think he still might run, though? If a Democrat wins, though, in 2008, that Democrat will no doubt run 4 years hence. So then he'd be what? By 2016, he'd be in his mid-60s.
Oh, early 60s. He's 54, you know, 54 now. And so even if it were 8 years, you know, later, he would still only be 62. And as the country ages, 62 is almost a kid. You know, probably it won't be too much longer when candidates run in their 70s. No one will even blink. John McCain's biggest liability is not that he's over 70 years old or will be when he goes to the White House if he got elected.
I'm curious as to how you're going to finish that sentence.
he has many more serious liabilities than his age, which is really a non-factor.
Feingold has been leading a couple other battles here while he's in the Senate, and he seems happy in the Senate, I have to say, leading the fight against this renewed license that the Democrats just gave President Bush on NSA spying. And Feingold has also been leading the way on censure. Though I wonder, he came out with a statement a few weeks ago that said he wasn't going to go for impeachment. And then he got kind of hammered on the internet by the bloggers for admitting that it may be that George W. Bush and Dick Cheney committed impeachable offenses, but we're not going to do that because we don't want to tie up everything right now, and we've got essentially more important things to do. And then shortly thereafter, he introduced this bill of censure. Do you have a sense as to what happened there?
Well, he introduced a censure proposal almost 2 years ago after the New York Times broke the warrantless wiretapping story in late 2005. Russ Feingold introduced a censure resolution several months after that and received very little support from his Democratic colleagues in the Senate. I think three people ultimately signed on with him. It's his way of trying to do two things. He talks about there ought to be something on the historical record that the country, in the form of a Senate censure resolution, does not approve of the kind of behavior both that led us into the Iraq War and the kind of warrantless wiretapping and torture, the abuses at Guantanamo, a real litany of civil liberties abuses, and that there has to be a norm established so that future administrations know that the public will not tolerate this. Now, it has no legal effect to pass a censure resolution. It's just the collective pointing a finger and saying, shame on you for doing this. And a lot of people who are so incensed with Cheney and Bush and the whole operation, really want to, throw them out of office. That's simply obviously not going to happen given the composition, especially of the Senate, even if there were a successful impeachment on the House side. So I think Feingold, who does say, as you said, that a lot of the behavior of the administration falls right within the strike zone of impeachable offenses, is being, in this case, a bit of a pragmatist, but doesn't want to let them get away and leave office scot-free.
I'm speaking with Sandy Horwood, author of a brand new, very interesting biography on Russ Feingold. And the question I have the book's called Feingold, no mistaking it, is how come other senators, Democratic senators, liberal Democratic senators, progressive Democratic senators, aren't aboard, you know, leave aside impeachment, aren't aboard censure, which, as you say, is just a little spanking. You know, there's no Ted Kennedy. There's no, I mean, the only people who signed on initially, again, were Tom Harkin and Barbara Boxer.
Well, it is a mystery at one level, Matt. I don't even know quite how to, you know, tell you, give you an answer. But it's pretty easy, and maybe it is an accurate way of looking at it, that there is just this cowardice, even among some of the Democratic senators that we respect. You know, there is such a groupthink in Washington, and it applies on both sides, among the Democratic establishment and the Republican establishment. And Russ Feingold is not part of the groupthink. And when these consultants come and tell Democratic leaders, for example, you know, you don't want to do this because it'll only stir up the Republican base, say, to come to Bush's defense. I mean, they have endless rationalizations for, you know, not standing up and doing things that so many real grassroots people would like to see. They are so angry. I'm talking now about especially grassroots Democrats.
But even the demand for impeachment is beyond that. I mean, I saw the latest poll, 45% want Bush impeached, 54% want Cheney impeached.
Well, and when you look at the independents, actually, I've seen polls that show even a higher percentage. I've seen a poll that shows a among Democrats in the country, over 60% want to see impeachment proceedings started, and 50% of independents, by a margin of 50-30%, also favor the beginning of impeachment proceedings. These are astonishing numbers, at least in my view. And so a censure resolution being, you know, considerably milder than that, one would think would gather a lot of support from Russ Feingold's at least Democratic colleagues in the Senate. And, you know, it remains to be seen if that's going to happen. You know, let me add one other quick thing. There is a subtitle to my book, and the subtitle is A New Democratic Party. So the book is called Feingold. The subtitle is A New Democratic Party. This is mainly a biography, but it's also an argument. And I'm very explicit about making this argument in the latter portion of this book. And that is that both the Democratic Party, I argue, and the country as well, really would be a lot better off if they had been following Russ Feingold's kind of politics over the last, say, decade. And the two biggest examples, or even three, are the Iraq War. Feingold, of course, voted against it. The civil liberties set of issues. And thirdly, the corruption in Congress. You know, in the 06 election, when Democrats did take back control of Congress, next to the Iraq War, which was the leading issue, the second most important was corruption. And if there is a, you know, Russ Feingold kind of issue, it is certainly good government and ethics in government. So had the Democratic Party just been doing what Russ Feingold had been doing for the last 10 years, they'd be way ahead of the game.
We're going to have to leave it at that. That's Sandy Horwitt, author of a brand new biography on Senator Russ Feingold from Wisconsin. It's called Feingold, and yes, there is a subtitle, A New Democratic Party. Sandy Horwitt, thanks for being my guest today.
Thanks, Matt.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.